calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, airamericaradio.com, and CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. CRN Digital, of course, getting us into cable TV systems all across the United States. So all sorts of interesting, strange ways that the signal is getting out there. Welcome back to our program, Your Light at the End of the Tunnel of Talk Radio. Lots to talk about today. In the category of, you know, this is fascinating stuff, is it gossip or not, just to sort of get it out of the way, because I actually... The main thing that I want to start talking about is economics, and are we facing a Great Depression, or are we facing a Weimar Republic style hyperinflation? And if so, if that possibility is real, A, why? B, what could be done about it? And C, what at an individual level should people be thinking about it? So I want to get into that in just a few minutes. And also be glad to take your calls. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, that's 440-8466. And, of course, if you want to drop into our live chat room, see what you've been missing, some of the finest minds on the Internet in live and real time, 1-866, yeah, you know, you do that on the web by going to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. And just click the live chat button right up at the top of the page, and it will take you to the live chat room. So, category one, if Dick Cheney is part of Treasongate, if Dick Cheney is one of the ones who is accused of, perhaps convicted of treason against the United States, will he resign? A lot of speculation around that. Second step, if he resigns, who takes his place? Is it going to be Condi Rice? A lot of speculation around that. And number three, if Condi Rice then is vice president, does she run for president on the Republican ticket in 2008 against the front runner, Hillary Clinton, on the Democratic side? Dick Morris, of course, came out with a book about this. Dick Morris, the rather weaselly character, in my opinion. I don't mean that as a character slam. I don't know. It's Dick Morris, a man of, let's say, easily changing loyalties. He worked for the Clintons, and now he makes a living attacking the Clintons on Fox News, by and large. And in any case, Dick Morris came out with a book about this some months ago, which he must have written like a year ago, saying that the big matchup coming is going to be Hillary versus Condi, and everybody's like, yeah, no, it can't be. But here's a scenario where it could actually be possible. We're just going to have to wait and see on this thing. But as I've been saying from day one, my concern about this goes beyond Dick Cheney. And this is where the two things that are not being focused on in the media. And, you know, I saw Amy Goodman on Hardball the other day doing such a great job at trying to bring Chris Matthews back to, you know, trying to bring the discussion back to the real issue here. And really, there are two of them. The biggest of the two issues is this is really not so much about the outing of a CIA agent and the treason that's involved in that and the incredible damage to the United States national security and our intelligence apparatus. I mean, that's there and that's real. But this is also about the fact that we were lied into a war and that it was an intentional series of lies. There was this, the Whigs, right? The Whigs are back. Remember when the Federalists imploded in the 1820s, the Whig Party, W-H-I-G, the Whig Party came and replaced them. And then the Whig Party imploded in the 1840s, early 1850s, and they got replaced by the modern Republican Party. The Whigs are back, only it's called the White House Iraq Group. W-H-I-G. And basically, it was a bunch of folks in the White House and Dick Cheney, part of it, who were pumping intelligence, cherry-picking intelligence, manipulating intelligence, intimidating the CIA, hassling people in the CIA and the State Department to make sure that they got what they wanted, whether it was right or not. And they got what they wanted, and they got the war they wanted, and it was wrong. And we can all look back on it and say, yep, it was wrong. So anyhow, the point that I've been making is that, you know, the two big issues here. Number one, really what this is about is that we were lied into a war, and this is an attempt to cover it up, to cover up the lies, to punish anybody who might have pointed out that we were lied into a war. Joe Wilson, for example. And in that context, then the whole Joe Wilson-Valerie Plame becomes a, for example, of the much larger issue, the much larger crime, in my opinion, of somebody using the power of the executive branch to lie this country into a war. War is the most drastic and draconian thing a nation can do. It involves the deaths of human beings. It involves great national treasure. It alters the course of history. It changes how we're viewed all around the world. We have nearly 2,000 American soldiers dead. We have, by the official estimates, we have 20 to 30,000, maybe as many as 40,000 physically, seriously wounded. Lives changed forever. We have what may end up being hundreds of thousands psychologically wounded for the rest of their lives. God only knows how many are going to end up like with Gulf War in 1991, where fully a third of the soldiers who served are now on long-term disability or serious disability as a result of exposure to, we're not sure what, depleted uranium, experimental vaccines, who knows? Weird diseases that we just don't have immunity to that are endemic in that region. Frankly, I think that's the weakest of the possibilities. Depleted uranium at the top of my list. So war is a really serious thing. It's more important than whether or not you're in favor of taxes or tax cuts or tax breaks or what kind of taxes you think you should have or whether or not there should be Social Security or whether or not you think that there should be. You know, war is the bottom line. It is the ultimate thing. Just like murder is the ultimate crime a person can be committed, can be convicted of. The ultimate crime that a person can commit is murder. The ultimate act that a nation can commit is war. It is no small thing. It is a very, very serious thing. And here we have an administration that lied us into a war and then tried to cover it up. And part of the cover-up was smashing, destroying, not just the reputation of anybody who challenged them, but the family of anybody who challenged them, even if that meant committing treason, outing a CIA agent, bringing down Brewster Jennings, an entire covert CIA operation, even if that was the price. And that's something we need to be talking about. And then, but wait, there's more, right? And then it gets even better, or worse, as the case may be. Today's New York Daily News reports that George Bush, 2 years ago, angrily rebuked Karl Rove for outing Valerie Plame. 2 years ago, about the same time he was telling you and me we don't know about any leaker. Maybe we'll find a leaker. Maybe we won't. I mean, who knows? Not really sure. Who knows? Time will tell. Maybe there'll be a leaker. Maybe there won't be a leaker.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, now, apparently he already knew at that point that it was Karl Rove. And then he went on to say, I don't know if anybody in my administration leaked classified information. If somebody did leak classified information, I'd like to know it. We'll take appropriate action. This investigation is a good thing. He said that on September 30th, 2 years ago. That's more than 2 years ago now. But the worst part, the New York Daily News writes, Bush rebuked Rove not because he committed treason, not because he was trying to punish somebody for political purposes, not because he was trying to cover up the lies that got us into Iraq. He rebuked Rove because Rove didn't cover his tracks well enough. To quote from the Daily News today, the New York Daily News, the president felt Rove and other members of the White House damage control team did a clumsy job in their campaign to discredit Plame's husband, Joe Wilson, the ex-diplomat who criticized Bush, blah de blah. A second well-placed source said some recently published reports implying Rove had deceived Bush about his involvement in the Wilson counterattack were incorrect and were leaked by White House aides trying to protect the president. You get this? These stories that say Rove lied to George Bush, they were leaks from Rove or from the White House trying to protect Bush. This is what I've been saying all along. In fact, Bush did not feel, again, the New York Daily News, Bush did not so much feel misled by Karl Rove and others as believing that they had handled it in a ham-handed and Bush League way, end quote, said the source. So Bush is not upset about the treason. He's not upset about the traitorous act. He's upset that they didn't do it well. They didn't cover their tracks good enough. They didn't do it like his daddy did when he was negotiating with the Iranians to hang on to the hostages and cheat Jimmy Carter out of an election. They didn't handle it as well as when, you know, John Roberts went down to Florida and helped his brother steal an election in 2000. You know, Karl Rove just, you know, maybe that's why he calls him Turd Blossom. He just didn't handle it all that well. So this could go all the way. This is worse than Watergate, my friends. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, what a crock! There you go. Welcome back, my friend. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. We'll get your calls in a few minutes. But first, I wanted to just wrap this up, and I wanted to give you an overview of this whole economic thing. This is something I think is really important. It's easy to get caught up in the jazz of the day and all the stuff that, you know, the hot news, as it were. And as I said, here's my concern with regard to this. My opinion, I've been saying this on this program for what, a year now? For some time, anyway. The memo, we've known for some time now that the State Department, that Colin Powell asked somebody at the State Department to find out who is this Joe Wilson guy and, you know, what do we know about him after Wilson wrote his op-ed piece in the New York Times. Within a few days of that, a memo was prepared and was sent to Colin Powell. That memo was either faxed to him while he was on Air Force One or was hand-delivered to him just as he was getting on Air Force One. Nobody's quite sure, apparently. I've seen reports of both. As Colin Powell, Ari Fleischer, and George W. Bush, among others, a few other people on their staff, were flying from the United States to Africa for the big thing where Bush was, you know, going to give away AIDS money, where he proclaimed that we were going to give out $15 billion in AIDS money, less than $1 billion of which we have actually distributed, although he loved taking credit for it. So anyhow, on that plane, you got Ari Fleischer, you've got Dan Bartlett, and you've got George W. Bush, and you have Colin Powell. Shortly thereafter, the assistant to the vice president and the assistant to the president, Scooter Libby and Karl Rove, are dialing for dollars. They're calling members of the media and committing treason, outing the identity of a CIA agent. And I've been saying all along, I don't think either one of these guys would have done this on orders from Dan Bartlett or from Ari Fleischer or even from Colin Powell. And frankly, I don't think Colin Powell would have ordered it. You know, he was part of a corrupt administration, but he's a guy that I think has at least some semblance, some shred of integrity. So who's left? Who on that airplane who had that memo could have passed the information along and said, do something about this, boys? George W. Bush. What did the president know, and when did he know it? Did he know this first, and then he passed it along to Cheney, and then Cheney said to Libby and Rove, do something? Did George Bush pass it along to Rove, and Rove passed it along to Cheney and Libby? I mean, how did the information get from the hands of Colin Powell and George Bush on Air Force One to the point where you've got these two guys dialing for dollars? And as I said, I think that the party that is being protected here by everybody is George W. Bush himself. But, you know, time will tell. Jerome Aparis over in the Daily Kos wrote an absolutely great piece a few days ago that it was, he said, inspired by an insightful exchange over at M. Stein, and yesterday, the day before his COES, this would have been on Saturday the 15th, in which Stein said the worldwide economic imbalances have gotten so extreme that the eventual reversion to the mean, that's fancy economic talk for going back to normal, cannot come with a soft landing. The sensible but optimistic inflationist probably sees something like the 70s. A pessimistic one sees another Weimar Germany. Now, Weimar Germany, this is after World War I, the Germans, everybody got together at the Treaty of Versailles and said, okay, we've got to punish those nasty Germans for their participation in World War I, and so we're going to make them pay us all back for what we lost. And the reparations were so huge, I mean, it was such a big chunk of Germany's GDP, that the Germans said, okay, fine, we owe you whatever, well, I don't remember the exact number now, it's been years since I studied this stuff, but, you know, let's say we owe you a trillion marks, okay, fine, we'll give you a trillion marks, we'll just run the printing presses and hand them to you. Well, that is one way to pay back your debt. It's called inflating your currency or decreasing the value of your currency. And it's what the Germans did. And the problem, of course, is that it meant that all of the German currency got deflated. So they were able to pay off their debt in like 2 years. But it literally took a bushel basket full of, or a wheelbarrow full of Deutschmarks, of German marks, to buy a loaf of bread. People were getting off, they were taking their coffee break, their lunch break, and their afternoon coffee break, and leaving work to go buy things, because by the time 2.5 hours later, when another break was available to them, the price would have gone up another 20 or 30%. I mean, that's serious, and it's called hyperinflation. Other people are talking about a deflation. A deflation, that's where the value of money actually goes up, but money becomes very, very hard to get. In other words, credit just goes away. You just can't borrow money. And if you don't have a lot of cash, you don't have a lot of liquid assets, you know, things like, you know, coins and things, then you're in deep trouble. And that's what the Great Depression was in the United States. That's what that's the severe example from here. In Japan, they've been having something close to that over the last, you know, over the last decade, in the 90s anyway, in Japan. Not a depression, but a deflationary period where the currency just gets stronger and stronger. Credit is harder and harder to get. Well, these folks over at the COES just laid out some startling numbers in graphic form, and I have to share these with you and, you know, let you draw your own conclusions, although I'll toss in mine as well. We'll get to that in just a minute. It's 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Don't stand by while democracy dies. Don't stand by. Don't swallow their lies. Don't stand by till we lose the prize. You've got to open your eyes.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, yeah, always good advice. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. If you go back to the late 1950s, early 1960s, the income, the national income in 2000, we'll translate all of this into 2003 dollars. Okay, so you don't have to worry about, you know, adjusted for inflation. This is all adjusted for inflation in trillions of dollars or thousands of billions of dollars. The national income around that time was around $3 trillion, you know, all of our collective income. It is now around $8 trillion in 2003 dollars. The American debt, that is federal, state, local government debt, plus business debt, plus household debt, the total debt of the United States was around $5 trillion. Not quite double the total income, the national income. But just about. And that's kind of a scary thing, in a way. That's sort of like, but on the other hand, you know, you say, well, you know, we can handle that. It's like, you know, somebody has a home and they have a $100,000 mortgage on it and they have a $50,000 a year income. In fact, there used to be an old formula that had to do with, you know, what size home you should buy versus, you know, based on your income and all that kind of thing. So you could say, you know, we can handle that. Okay. So then we get, and it's slowly, and the national debt, you know, slowly went up through the 60s, 65, 69, 73. It was up to about $8 trillion. 77, it was pushing around $10 trillion. Most of this debt as a result of the Vietnam War, by the way. 1981, 11 trillion. And then Ronald Reagan came into office. And Ronald Reagan said, hey, we want to make things look good. I want to be remembered as the president who was the president when things were feeling good, when things were nice. And so he started borrowing money like crazy and spending it. And it has become the Republican mantra ever since, of course. And not more than, you know, there's no shortage of Democrats, by the way, who have jumped on this bandwagon as well. And so we saw the national income increasing very slowly through the 80s. Went from around $5 trillion in 1981 to around $5.1 trillion in 1985 to around $6 trillion in 1990. So a very, you know, kind of slow, gradual increase, kicked up a little bit more rapidly during the Clinton years. But the national debt, Reagan comes into office, is a $10 trillion, so it's double what our income is. By the time Reagan leaves office, we're at $20 trillion national debt. Then it levels off for a while in the $20 trillion range for a couple of years while Bill Clinton's in there being reasonably fiscally sane. And by the way, we should acknowledge some of the House was under the control of the Republicans for a while there. And so it wasn't entirely Bill Clinton being fiscally responsible. There were a few fiscally responsible Republicans as well who were, you know, proposing reasonable spending bills. But then, you know, George W. Bush comes in 2000. And boom, we go from $22 trillion to $30 trillion to $35 trillion to $40 trillion, where it was $37 trillion in 2003. It's over $40 trillion now. But our national income is still around $8 trillion. So, you know, you look at that and it's like, you know, you just imagine a chart and it's just, you know, this sudden explosion. Debt has reached new highs. And a lot of people are very concerned about this, a lot of professional economists. In fact, interesting piece in the front page of the money section of today's USA Today about how the president may appoint somebody to replace Greenspan really soon, like mid-November, which is going to cause Congress to have to really scramble to have confirmation hearings before they take a recess for Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays. And frankly, the reason they have to do this is because Greenspan has said he's not going to stay in the office after the end of the year. Now, he can. Even though his term expires, he could stay there for another year or two. He's just not willing to do it. I think he's not willing to do it because he knows that the roof is about to fall in. And he doesn't want to be the guy whose name is attached to it. Even though, in large part, Alan Greenspan is the guy who set this up. It was Greenspan and Ronald Reagan who came up with this whole idea of, you know, let's borrow like crazy. And everybody will think times are wonderful and we're brilliant politicians. And they'll love the Republican Party forever, in particular. And, I mean, the Democrats used to borrow and used to tax and spend. They'd say, okay, we'll raise people's taxes and give them, you know, schools and Social Security and things that they want. And they'll be happy with us and they'll vote for us. And people said, that's really cool. We like that. We'll vote for you. Yeah, you raised our taxes, but you gave us Social Security and you gave us a national highway system and things like that. That was okay. But Reagan was like, hey, don't even raise their taxes. In fact, reduce their taxes. We'll borrow it from their grandchildren. They'll never even notice. They'll be dead by the time their grandchildren have to start paying it back. Well, it hasn't taken as long as Reagan had thought. It's catching up with us much more rapidly. And in fact, it turns out that what is happening now is that an awful lot of the money that's being spent, particularly over the last few years, has been extracted from our homes. If you look, this from a source of the Northern Trust Company, you know, a bank put together this national annual home equity extraction in billions of dollars. And from 1955 to 1980, when Reagan came in, it was essentially zero. It was essentially flat. It went down for a while because you had interest rates going up really high the first couple of years of the Reagan administration. Then the interest rates started going down. And it went down. And then it went up through the late 80s. It went down again in the early 90s. And then we hit George W. Bush in the year 2000. And it went from zero to $300 billion a year that people were taking out of the value of their homes, borrowing against their homes and spending this money. And this has been, and this year, the last number I saw was that it's $600 billion in 2004, the last year that was reported. So what this means is that as long as people can borrow against the increasing value of their homes and spend that money, then they may be able to, in theory, then they may be able to keep the economy going. But when they can't borrow against their homes anymore, you've got no economy, because what's happened is the trade policies of Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush have exported all of our good jobs. You know, the good union jobs are pretty much, by and large, gone. There's this all-out war on organized labor. We've turned sovereignty, we've turned the ability of we the people, government, us, you know, our elected representatives, we have turned that sovereignty over to multinational corporations in the form of the World Trade Organization and NAFTA and CAFTA and, you know, in the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs and the General Agreement on Trades and Services, the GATT and GATS. And so now the only folks who are really making out like bandits are the big multinational corporations and the big banks. The big banks seen this coming last year, got a bankruptcy so-called reform pushed through, so that even if you get wiped out because you played the game the way they told you to play the game, and keep in mind, half of all people in America who declare bankruptcy do so because of medical bills that they hadn't expected. A third of all people in America who declare bankruptcy do so because of death or divorce. If you played the game by the rules, did your best, put in your time, and you just got blindsided, now under this new bankruptcy law, tough luck. You are a slave for the rest of your life to the companies that you owe money to. You can't, you know, the traditional American values of encouraging risk and forgiveness of loans for people who, you know, now we're not talking about fraud here. You know, with fraud, you can prosecute, but you could always prosecute bankruptcy fraud. It was done regularly. But anyhow, so now here, this piece in the Daily Kos on Sunday, House equity withdrawals now have stopped. Last year, $600 billion. This year, bang, it's come to a screeching stop. And according to Freddie Mac, 31% of all of our consumption in the United States is coming from people borrowing money against their house and spending it. So you get increasing energy prices. They have just doubled the minimum payments on credit cards. You've got lower withdrawal of home equities. Fewer people are taking money out of their increasing value in their homes because the increasing value of the homes is slowing down. It's not increasing as much as it was. And lenders pretty soon are going to start putting the screws on. I mean, right now you've got a bunch of lending institutions who are not really banks. They simply they arrange the mortgage for you or the second mortgage for you, and then they sell it in the secondary market. They have no risk, and they're willing to do some really dicey, chancy stuff because very profitable. Some people just becoming billionaires on this stuff, multimillionaires on this stuff. And it's creating a very, very dangerous time for the United States. So you take this triple whammy of increasing energy prices, doubling the minimum payments on credit cards, and people can't take money out of their homes anymore. And what do you have? People can't spend money. People can't spend money. There's nothing, you know, the stores aren't selling anything. They start laying off people. Factories start laying off people. And boom, you've got a downward spiral. It's referred to as a slowdown or a recession, or if it goes really fast or really hard, even a depression. Now, China is going to take a hit on this. And if they take a hit on it and they stop buying the U.S. treasuries, because we're not buying Chinese goods anymore, and right now we're borrowing money from them to buy their stuff, and the way that we're borrowing that money is we're selling them treasuries. We're giving them IOUs called treasuries. If China stops buying U.S. treasuries, then we can't sell our treasuries. Our interest rates are going to go through the roof because we're borrowing $1 billion a day. George W. Bush is borrowing $1 billion a day to keep it looking like, you know, to keep this house of cards up. And if China walks away from that, boom, I mean, the floor could fall out. So, you know, the bottom line, you know, in terms of here's, you know, crazy Uncle Tom's advice. If you have a mortgage, get a fixed rate mortgage. So it's not cranking with the interest rates, because it wouldn't surprise me if within a year or two we're seeing 15, 20, 25% interest rates. Frankly, it wouldn't surprise me if we're seeing 60, 70, 80% interest rates. That would be the worst case scenario. But and pay down your debt as fast as you can, as much as you can. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Truth and common sense in broadcasting.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Bring them on.
To all the troops I sent to war, who won't be coming home no more, I'm glad you came along. I dedicate this song to all the troops I sent to war.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, our program brought to you today by Motor Silk, 1-866-LESS-FUEL, evergreenamerica.com. Increase your gas mileage, reduce your internal friction on your engine by bonding boron, of all things, to all your metal parts. Speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of the United States of America. Well, actually broadcasting live from Portland, Oregon as well. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. In addition to trying to get yourself out of any kind of, you know, people say, well, what can I do? You know, what, you know, if Reagan and Clinton and Bush have Bush have really set us up for this economic disaster as a result of Reaganomics and conservative economics, conservative trade policies, if they've really set this thing up as badly as you say, Mr. Hartman, you know, what shall I do? Number one, get out of any kind of interest bearing note, you know, any kind of debt that has the ability to have the interest rate changed on you. So, you know, pay off your credit cards as fast as you can. And if you have a home mortgage, or the extent that you have a home mortgage, or are remortgaging or whatever, make sure that it's a fixed rate mortgage, that it cannot change under any circumstances. Number one. Number two, downscale. You know, start, you know, if you're spending 100% of your income on your lifestyle, figure out a way to only spend 80% of your income on your lifestyle and start putting a little money aside. Even if it means not going out for dinner as often or not, you know, whatever. And I don't mean to sound like, you know, somebody's grandmother, but you know, it's real. It really is. And number three, have a little liquidity, you know, be ready. What happens if there is a crash? I don't want to bring it about by talking about it. I frankly don't think that I have the ability to bring it about by talking about it on the radio, but I certainly think that we all need to be saying, you know, what do we do if there's a real disaster? So, but that's not the only thing in the world. There's a lot of other issues out there as well. You know, what's going on with Iraq, what's going on with Bill O'Reilly. I mean, you know, take your choice. Our phone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. And Steve in Eureka, it's Eufaula, Oklahoma?
That's right,
Eufaula, Oklahoma. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Well, I've been missing you. I haven't been able to be in my car and get to Sirius, but I called in today, and I was laughing about Bill O'Reilly. I was thinking he's got the big boycott on everything that's French, and I guess Tamiflu is our only hope against avian flu right now. And that's made by the French pharmaceutical Roche.
Yeah, it's a Swiss company, but it's
Swiss?
Yeah, it's in the French part of Switzerland. If that helps, they speak French in that part of Switzerland.
Okay.
But yeah, it's close enough.
Maybe we can nail him down to boycott the Tamiflu.
Yeah, could be. On Sunday or on Saturday, I spoke at the Bioneers Conference in San Rafael, and I went and visited Veronique Raskin, an old friend of mine who owns the organic wine company. She lives in San Rafael. It's where the company's based. And or ecowine.com is their website, or 188. What is the number? 1-888 ecowine. Yeah, is their phone number. And had a great glass of wine with her. And she said that when Bill O'Reilly declared his boycott of all things French back, what, 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago,
yeah,
it really hurt their business. And she still gets, you know, from time to time calls, you know, people calling up and yelling, "Hey, you're damn Frenchies, rah rah rah," like that, because she's French,
yeah,
and they sell imported organic French wines. But she said that business pretty much bounced back. So, you know, I think O'Reilly and his comical, you know, I mean, we wouldn't have the United States if the French hadn't loaned us the money to fight the Revolutionary War. So O'Reilly's becoming increasingly, I think, perceived as sort of a pathetic act. It's last night on and thanks for the call. I appreciate your comment. Last night on The Daily Show, They had, you know, John Stewart was on with him. He had Bill O'Reilly on, made an interesting comment.
I'm reading an article today, and this is true. In an article today, Newsday, you're actually talking about retirement. You're talking about being tired of doing this.
Well,
it's wearing you down.
9 years.
Been on, yeah,
oh, that's not right.
No, I mean, look, I've been doing it for 9 years.
All right.
And we fight a lot of battles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to do it. But I have to basically bring every night to the table a sense of outrage because there's lots of things wrong. You know, we're not playing it for giggles like you. Look at me. Look at me.
Now, you ought to know this. The world could blow the hell up. He'd be giggling. Oh, this is right.
How many people are dead in Katrina? How can we make fun of it? Let's get Colbert in here. Let's get the other guy, Lewis, in here. We'll make fun of the hurricane.
You know,
that's what you do.
I will say this. We do add insult to injury.
You do.
But.
He's an honest man.
But.
He's an honest man.
You add injury.
I am.
There you go. But, Bill O'Reilly, you add injury to injury, yeah. So, you know, I think that, good on you, John Edwards. Our congratulations for the day. Well said. Oh, my goodness. Doug in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Doug, what's up? Doug, you're live and on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Okay.
What's up?
About the Saddam trial.
Yeah.
I was curious why they're trying him on this case in the early 80s where he killed some, like, 140 people or something in an assassination attempt.
Right.
Why he's not being tried on the charge of gassing the Kurds in 88.
Well, there was a report from the CIA that didn't get much mention. It was published in on Common Dreams, and it made the national press, suggesting that actually Saddam hadn't gassed the Kurds, that the Kurds were in a crossfire between Saddam and the Iranians during the Iranian War, and that it was gas from the Iranians that killed the Kurds. Nobody's really sure, so that's probably why they're not prosecuting him for that. It makes a nice soundbite to talk about it, but I'm not sure that they've got a solid case on that, so they're going after him for something that they do have a solid case on, which is where he had, you know, these people tried to assassinate him, and so he just went in and said, okay, that's it. You know, you try to kill me, I'll show you, which is, you know, what dictators do really well. Thanks for the call, and thanks for raising it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the Matrix.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here, where despair is not an option. Get active, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Tom Hartman Radio Program. Casey in Seattle, Washington had a quick question. Hey, Casey, what's on your mind today?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was just calling. Okay, so we're borrowing like $1 billion from China a day.
Not all of it from China, about a third of it. But
okay.
Yeah.
And then if they don't want to buy like our IOU/treasuries,
right?
Then basically we're just like.
Well, we're not just totally out of luck. What happens is that, you know, and the Saudis are buying a bunch of them, by the way, as well. In fact,
like, how retarded is that? Just to buy like their stuff, right?
That's right. It's extremely retarded. Yeah,
right.
We have a $600 billion trade deficit with them every year, which means we buy $600 billion worth of stuff from them more than we sell to them. And in order to be able to pay them, we have to borrow money from them at the rate of $1 billion a day, about $300 billion a year. And so what happens is if they say, we're not going to buy your treasuries anymore, then we have to go around the world and say, well, somebody please buy these treasuries. And you know, a lot of countries are selling debt instruments, you know, treasury bills right now. Canada does. In fact, almost all countries do. They do to some extent. Right now, for example, hot ones are New Zealand and Australia because they're considered very safe and their currencies are solid. Canadian debt is really good right now also because their currency is actually getting stronger relative to the dollar. So what we would have to do is we would have to say, okay, we're going to offer you a higher rate of return. In other words, we'll say, right now we're paying you 3% or 4%. We'll pay you 5% or 6% if you buy our bills. Now, that does two things. One, it causes interest rates all across the United States to start cranking up. Number two, it means that the corporations that are also selling debt,
right,
who, you know, in order to finance their businesses, they're going to have to raise the interest rates they're willing to pay on their debt, which means that they're less profitable, which means that debt is more expensive for them, which means that a lot of corporations just plain old flat out go out of business
and
you have more bankruptcies. Yeah, I mean, we saw this.
Debt. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yep.
Well, is there any more that I can learn about, like, the Reagan and the Greenspan borrowing? Because that,
yes,
you know, from Social Security, that blows my mind, too.
There is a brilliant book about it called Greenspan's Fraud by Ravi Batra. Ravi was a guest on this program back about 5-6 months ago when the book first came out. I ought to get him back on again because he's so articulate. And
that
the book
was just, I was like, no way.
Yeah, it really was. And in fact, when Reagan started borrowing all that money, when Reagan ran the country into debt with the tax cuts, we talked about this yesterday, Greenspan said, well, if you borrow it from Social Security, nobody will know you're borrowing money because it doesn't show up as part of the debt. You know, it's just government borrowing from government. Yeah, and it doesn't show up until people start retiring and, you know, 2020. And guess
so
what?
Dirty.
I know. It is. It really is. That's why Greenspan wants to get out of town as fast as he can.
So Greenspan's fraud. And what's the author again?
Ravi Batra. B-A-T-R-I-R-A.
Thank you so much,
you're welcome. Thanks for calling, Casey. Good to hear from you. Alec Dubrow with the International Labor Communications Association is on the line. Alec, regular on our program, ILCAonline.org, the website. And Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great.
You gave the bad news from Capital just now. I'll give the bad news from Labor.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the used to be our newspapers for 200 years in the United States had labor news in them all the time. And the last 20 years or so, since Reagan took over, essentially, and all the newspapers and network TV and radio got bought up by huge corporations that are not interested in just sharing the news, but are interested in making it. All of a sudden, all we know is the stock market. So you're our regular dose of labor. And so what's going on with labor?
You mean I'm the only hope we have? Gee, that's a big word.
That's pretty great.
Well,
pretty
here's one of the things that the papers leave out. The International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, it's the largest agglomeration of unions in the world, based in Brussels. They released their annual survey of violations of trade union rights. You know, this is like a human rights violation release. If Human Rights Watch released it, it would probably get some coverage because it's labor. Nobody mentions it. But I looked in it. There are certainly more dramatic ones than what's going on in the United States. Last week we talked about Colombia and the assassinations. But then when I looked at the U.S., I thought of that line from Bowling for Columbine where Michael Moore says, thank you for not shooting me. I mean, that's about all we're getting from employers now is they're not shooting us.
Well, tell that to the people at Delphi.
Exactly.
I mean, here you have a company saying to its employees, you're going to have to take a 2/3 cut in pay, and, you know, welcome to the new America.
Well, you know,
welcome to Bushland.
The playing field with Latin America and East Asia.
We're only 1/10 of the way there toward leveling the playing field, Alec.
Understand.
I mean, this is a process. People think that we're at the end of this process. I'm telling you, as long as Bushonomics, Reaganomics, Clintonomics, for that matter, in terms of international trade, as long as these policies stand, we are just at the leading edge of this thing. We are only 6-8% of, you know, backed. We've opened the door and we've just kind of started to back in, you know, our butt is halfway in the other room and the rest of us hasn't even started to enter. I mean, that's what's going on.
It is grim. And part of this, of course, has to do with the removal of trade union rights. I mean, one of the things, in fact, the principal thing that gives workers equality with employers are unions. I mean, they can't do it individually, but they can do it collectively.
Right. I say on this program, the only thing that stands between you and I, not necessarily you and I, Alec,
yeah,
but between my listeners and I, and on the one side, well, you too, on the one side, and Victorian era England economics or robber baron era economics, the world of Charles Dickens, the world of the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers, where you have conspicuous wealth and an enormous poor working class. I mean, keep in mind, 67% of all people in the United States living in poverty are working full-time. Full-time! The only thing that stands between us and that world is organized labor in the United States. That's it.
All right, that's it. And we do not, at this point, have government on our side, which is the key. What I ran across here is in the... They talked about here captive audience meetings, and this is a very key issue, which is during an organizing campaign, when workers are considering joining a union, employers, and we've mentioned this, can force them to attend meetings where they are harangued, usually by anti-union, union-busting consultants,
now,
on the evils of labor.
Yeah, now let me just interrupt you for a second here, Alec, if I can.
Absolutely.
I have a historical question here. It's something I don't understand. My understanding is that the Wagner Act of 1935, that the main thing that the Wagner Act said was that an employer cannot interfere with employees who are in the process of trying to unionize.
Well, that's the overall concept, but of course it was whittled down by various rulings of the National Labor Relations Board, which
and by Taft-Hartley.
And the courts, of course.
Right.
Until 1956, there was equal access, at least in theory, in the workplace. Where
meaning
if there was a meeting, they had to give union representatives as much time as management representatives. In 56, now we're talking before Reagan here. In 56,
sure.
The NLRB ruled no, this would infringe upon employer free speech.
Well, this was during a Republican administration. This was during the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah. It was under Eisenhower that was turned around. But nobody fought to reinstate the equal access rule. And today, 92% of organizing campaigns, workers are forced into these meetings. And I was talking to a lawyer here who said...
Workers are forced into these meetings where management tells them how evil labor is, and labor doesn't have an opportunity to respond.
That's correct. And while they can't threaten, they can predict that the plant will close if the workers join the union. You tell me what the difference in that is, and you know, I'll pay your salary. Essentially, they're allowed to threaten workers with loss of job if they join the union.
So what's the bottom line here, Alec? What do we do?
Well, I mean, these are desperate times. And essentially, one is to make people aware of this. I mean, people are either accepting of the fact that that employer free speech takes precedence over worker freedom of association, self-organization, designation of representatives. I would say most working people haven't the faintest idea that this exists. I mean, in order to get people charged up about it, in order to ask representatives to help change this law, first people have to be aware that it's a problem and that there's a connection between this and their falling salaries and their loss of benefits.
Right. We have about a half a minute left. Alec, would it be safe to say that the message that you want to send to our elected representatives, if you call them at 202-225-3121, the main number in Congress for the, you know, Capitol Hill, or of those people who are running for offices, do you support organized labor?
Support organized labor and the proposed Employee Free Choice Act, which would prevent this sort of stuff.
Okay, the proposed Employee Free Choice Act. That's
go to the AFL-CIO website. It's up there.
Okay, great. AFLCIO.org.
That's correct.
Great. Okay, thank you so much. Alec Dubrow, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org, 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
See how they explain the inexplicable. Watch them all debate the undebatable. Apparently a lie is never liable. Prime time for a talk show screamer.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. You're in the middle of the real free speech zone, the no boring zone, the actual free speech zone, no barbed wire, no RNC pass permit required. You're welcome to give us a shout at 866-440-8466, 440-TOM. Toll free 1-866-440-8466. 440-THOM, our new phone number, our new toll-free number, and to drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com, click live chat, and visit in, say hello, and like that. So here we have, just to recap, this fiscal position, one of the discussions that the folks in the chat room have been having is about, is it time to get out of banks and into credit unions, for example? And I've always thought, you know, credit unions are great. They're just absolutely great. And some of the big banking institutions, my sense of it is that the banks were looking at this future that Reagan and Greenspan and Bush and Clinton created for us. And we're saying, you know, not such a good thing coming. And that's why they were pushing so hard for this legislation that changed the bankruptcy laws to cover their butts, to protect themselves, in my opinion. So, you know, it may be that they've sufficiently reduced their risk that you don't have to worry about banks. I don't want to be alarmist or hysterical here. On the other hand, we are confronting a disparity in wealth between average Americans and the most wealthy among us. You know, the roughly 17,000 of us who own roughly 40-50% of America. We are looking at a disparity that we haven't seen since 1929. And that many scholars of the Great Depression say was one of the principal things that was responsible for the Great Depression, for the collapse. And we're seeing it as a result, in large part, of the same kind of economic policies. Herbert Hoover came into office, good Republican. What did he do? 6 tax cuts for the rich. Following the Supreme Court, you know, a decade earlier, saying that it was illegal to have, you know, for the government to support organized labor in organizing, that it was illegal to have minimum wage laws, that it was unconstitutional, that it was socialism to have unemployment insurance, that child labor laws were against the law. David Sirota, by the way, in the Huffington Post today, great piece. What's the difference between a liberal and progressive? This is just, you know, so nice and tight. He did such a great job. In just to boil it down, basically, David Sirota is suggesting that liberals use liberal solutions, as it were, to make our society work better, and use taxpayer money to do it unashamedly. Yes, we collectively want some things, like we want our fire department to be there if our house catches on fire, God forbid. We want our police department to be there if we should have a problem. We want our roads to work. And we're willing to pay for it. That's called taxes. Taxes are the price you pay for a civil society. And those people who don't want to pay taxes are freeloaders and leeches on a civil society. It's really that simple. And Americans understood that right up until Reagan came along and started trying to change the paradigm. So liberals say, hey, you know, we have a civil society. There are things that we can do to improve society. We're going to pay for them with tax dollars. And that's a long tradition. I mean, it literally goes back to George Washington, who said, I hope evermore to see America at the forefront of liberality. George Washington, who called himself a liberal. But progressives are somewhat different. Most progressives are liberals. That is, they look at programs like, as David Sirota points out, the low-income home energy assistance program, you know, where we're going to help out, we're going to prevent people from freezing in their homes. And say, yeah, we're in favor of that. Or, you know, financial aid. People can get into college. They can move. We can create social mobility. People can move around. But progressives go a step beyond that and say, we want to challenge the institutions that challenge we the people. In other words, we're going to take on big pharma. We're going to take on corporations that claim that they have the rights of persons. The example that David Sirota gives is Barack Obama. He says a good example of this hesitation, a guy who's a liberal but not a progressive, Barack Obama. He talks about his health care to hybrids proposal. As the Detroit News reports, Obama is calling to use government money to relieve Detroit automakers of some of their staggering health care obligations if they commit to improving fuel economy by 3% a year for 15 years. Well, that's, you know, we all like to see health care improve for auto workers. We all want to see improved fuel efficiency standards. But why should we basically say to an industry, we're going to give you welfare if you'll do something that we like? Why not simply say to the industry, hey, you guys don't have the right to behave in a way that is ultimately destructive to our society. You know, the old saying, when you travel alone, you travel with Osama. And so, you know, paying off, as David Sirota says, paying off corporations to do what they already should be doing sets a dangerous precedent. So we need liberals who are also progressives. That's a great distinction. Thank you, David Sirota, for that. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Give me some shelter. We need it. We got a vice president who might be going to jail. We got a president who maybe set up treason and then lied about it. We've got a secretary of state who might end up being, don't even begin to think. Condi Rice for president. Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. on the line with us. TalkRadioNews.com, their website. Greg, our correspondent from Washington, D.C. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, Tom, thank you. I was actually going to talk about Condoleezza Rice, and you sort of mentioned her name. She's on the Hill today talking to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about what is happening in Iraq. And this morning we heard that she said there are 9 troop-ready battalions, or, you know, war-ready battalions.
This is up from 1 2 weeks
right,
ago?
That's exactly what I was going to say. It was up from 1. I mean, is that the fastest turnaround you've ever heard about? Or?
Well, we went from 1, and then Bush said there were, what, 60 or 30?
I think 30.
Yeah.
I actually thought I had heard more than 30 at one point. Now, according to the Secretary of State, it's 9. So
okay.
It's taken us 2.5 years to get 9 battalions ready. I'm not even sure if that number's right, although I'd like to think I could trust the Secretary of State if she goes before a hearing and saying there are 9. Let's go with that until we hear something else, I guess.
You know, Greg Gorman, it almost to me doesn't matter. I mean, the bottom line to me is when do Iraqis stop killing Iraqis, and when do Iraqis stop killing Americans, and when do Americans stop killing Iraqis, for that matter? Not that that's you know what we're all about or trying to do, but I don't know if the number of battalions is some kind of measure of success. In my opinion, it's not. The measure of success is how many people have died, what kind of attacks are happening, and certainly we're not seeing any kind of reduction in the violence in Iraq.
Well, that's exactly what I think there's some kind of, sorry, that siren in the background. Really,
that's okay.
Loud.
We can hear you over it.
I totally agree with you. I think that it's a little bit of a red herring for us to talk about these battalions and try to make that into what's really going on the ground. I mean, I don't think it is. Just because the Iraqis are now semi-capable of policing themselves, it does not mean that the killing is going to stop. Because if it did, we would see a reduction in numbers based on how many battalions are ready. We have not. And, of course, I agree with you in that this has nothing to do with that. This has to do with we are still dying over there. Iraqis are still dying. There's still an insurgency that the White House did not plan on. And when is that going to stop? That's what we don't know.
Right. And even larger, we were lied into this thing. What do you think about the gossip that's running around Washington, D.C., that Dick Cheney may be indicted, that he may step down as vice president, that if he does, Bush is going to appoint Condi Rice, and that then it's going to be Condi versus Hillary in 2008, and that Condi is the only Republican who could beat Hillary. Quack, 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 quack. What are your thoughts on all that?
I mean, I think that if you turned on your television set and you came across a political TV show where the vice president was going to be arrested and thrown in jail, and the Secretary of State was going to be elevated to that job with 3 years left in an administration so that then she could run against the only other woman who has a chance of winning the presidency, you might think, wow, that's really good television. That's a really good scripted drama. I don't know if that's going to happen in real life, but you know what? You're right. It is the gossip around town. This whole investigation with the special prosecutor and Plamegate, it sort of turned a little bit, we heard yesterday, to focus more on the vice president. And now we know that it's fully on the vice president. There are no indictments yet, but I was at the White House this morning, and a lot of people around the halls are talking about the vice president and that he's in more trouble than we thought before. I have a feeling that Scooter Libby will be indicted no matter what now. If not Karl Rove, I've always kind of thought that Scooter Libby is going to be the person who's going to take the fall. Regardless of what he did, he's squarely in the middle of the vice president's office as his chief of staff. And Cheney does sort of have those big shoulders. He likes to take all the blame and all the responsibility. If he thinks he can step aside to make the president look better, he will.
Yeah, you call it Plamegate. I prefer to call it Treasongate. I mean, let's keep in mind what really happened here and what this is all about. It's not about Valerie Plame. It's about lying us into war and then covering it up.
Well, you know, Tom, that's a good point that I actually wasn't as aware of until the last few days. Now, I think we can all agree that what happened with Valerie Plame, her reporting and her stories and her sources are what helped us get into this war in Iraq. And the president is fully at fault for that. And so now, you're right, this is bigger than just one name being leaked of a CIA operative. This is about getting into a war with bad intelligence. And
it wasn't bad intelligence, Greg. It was cooked intelligence.
Yeah.
Because they had good intelligence. I mean, there were people who quit the CIA over this, saying, hey, we're telling them the truth, and they don't want to hear it, and they're refusing to listen to us.
Well, and of course, all this stems back from Joe Wilson, who went to Niger, and you know, he comes home and says, look,
there's no there there
being purchased by Iraq, and you're choosing not to listen to me. And the vice president went on the Sunday shows in 2003 and said he's never met Ambassador Wilson and that he'd never seen his intelligence. It was,
yeah,
you know, squarely in the face of it. That intelligence was wrong, and this administration chose to ignore it.
Yeah, and then you get Dick Cheney, you know, saying,
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, could that be what it's all about? Here we have the president of an oil company as of our vice president trying to lie us into a war in an area that has 10% of the world's oil reserves. Could be. My favorite theory is that Bush, you know, wanted to have a war so that he could be, you know, a war president. He wanted to be the FDR of the era. And instead, he's going to be the goat.
He was getting himself into.
Yeah, instead, he's going to be the goat. Very interesting to see how it's all going to play out. Greg Gorman of the Talk Radio News Service. Greg, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
Much appreciate the report. Always great to have you here. Greg Gorman, talkradionews.com. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. And Karen in Federal Way, Washington, is on the line. Hey, Karen, welcome. Karen? Hello, Karen. She's gone. Let's go to Alan in Seattle. Hey, Alan.
Hello. How's it going, Mr. Hartman?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I'm a veteran, so I take every on this area, I'm a combat veteran, so I take this very seriously, and it kind of drags on me, because no one who's actually been in combat, I think, ever really wants to go back to combat.
Including Colin Powell.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, he was the one voice in this administration that was saying, hey, wait a minute, guys.
Yeah, a lot of us are just a little bit too sane, I think, for that.
Yeah.
But I've been reading a lot of history, and I'm a student of history. Back in 1765, people just couldn't take it anymore. And there, you know, a group of people like the Sons of Liberty got together. At what point, given what's happening with our Justice Department, we're losing it, with our executive branch, we're losing it, at what point does it come where we, like our forefathers, have the right to say enough is enough? And given I've been through civil wars in Central America, and now we see what's happening with Iraq, do we really want that to come to the U.S., but what is the alternative?
Well, the reality is that from the founding of the Sons of Liberty,
yeah,
in the 1760s, the Boston Tea Party in 1773, 1776, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, that during that period of time, there was no way to modify, forget change, there was no way to even,
yeah,
modify the government that was in place. The governments that were, the people who were governing the individual colonies, the governors of the colonies, were, by and large, in almost every single case, actually also the main representatives of the East India Company in those colonies. And so you had
also appointed with charters by the Crown. I know that.
That's right. So you had this merger of corporate and state power that was unassailable. Now, at least in the United States, we have a vote. We have the ability, in theory anyway, to change our government. The thing that I think could push this country over the edge into some sort of civil disorder. And I lived through the 70s when we had, you know, cities burning, and you know, it was pretty scary, but it was nothing compared to the Civil War, obviously. And I don't think that we're going to see anything like the Civil War. But the thing that I think could push this country into something like going back to the 70s is if there is a widespread perception after the 2006 or the 2008 election
are actually running it.
That the elections were stolen by electronic voting machines.
Yeah, and we're already seeing a lot of that, and we're seeing, but not just election machines, we're seeing other fraud of other sorts that are being manipulated, like the lack of voting machines or the lack of access to.
Oh yeah, and people get it, but I you know, you look at Bush's poll numbers. I mean, there's no amount of advertising that's going to get him out of this thing. I mean, people have seen behind, they've pulled back the curtain and they've seen the guy behind there, and he's not the great and wonderful Wizard of Oz. He's a mean little man, you know, who's very vengeful and who doesn't want to hear anybody else's opinion, doesn't read newspapers, doesn't watch TV, and for 4 days had no idea what was going on in New Orleans because he lives in a bubble. I mean, you know, we Americans have figured that out, but what we have to get, those of us who are, you know, concerned about the future of the United States, what we have to get is that it's no longer about George W. Bush. He's not running for office. It's about taking back our political processes. And that means, number one, you've got one entire party that is totally corrupted. The Republican Party has been totally, you know, with maybe four exceptions, you know, Susan Collins and George Voinovich and Olympia Snowe, maybe you've got, you know, half a dozen exceptions at the most in the Republican Party who are not totally corrupt. You know, arguably John McCain. And then you've got a good third of the Democratic Party that has been corrupted. And it is, you know, if the people of the United States stand up and say enough of this, I think, you know, I really think that much like Herbert Hoover in retrospect was sort of, you know, it was a terrible thing that happened, you know, his policies destroying the economy of this country. But it woke Americans up to what had been going on for literally for three generations, you know, since Reconstruction, and brought about Franklin Roosevelt and the renewal of America. And I think that we are potentially standing on the edge of a great renewal in America. And it just, and what's going to make it happen, and, you know, Alan, is if you and I can reach enough people with that simple message that, you know, we need to wake up, we need to be, you know, sharing the message, you know, tag, you're it, right? That's the message.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Alan, for the call, and thanks for your service to your country. I honor you as a veteran, particularly as a combat veteran of the United States of America. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been meek and hard like an oak. I've seen pretty people disappear like smoke. Friends will arrive, friends will disappear. If you want me, honey, baby, I'll be here.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. You're in the middle of the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Take no imitations whatsoever. Welcome back to our program. 866-440-THOM, 440-8466, if you'd like to be on the program. And Grant in Eureka, California, listening on, KGOE there, Grant. What's up? Hey, Grant. You are live and on the air. You got to listen to the phone instead of the radio. And apparently Grant's listening to his radio, so
now,
we'll go to Karen. Hey, Karen.
Tom, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Wonderful. I just want to say very quickly, I saw the John Stewart, Bill O'Reilly thing on a teeny tiny screen on my computer this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they were playing it for laughs, both of them. Now, are my perceptions warped or what?
Well, I think that they were, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
You know, to a certain extent. I mean, John, you know, kind of stuck in the knife when he said, you know, we add insult to injury, you add injury to injury.
Yeah, right. That was a good one, right.
But, you know, basically, it's show business. And you know, these guys both get it, that it's show business. And
right,
you know,
right.
It's,
well, I thought O'Reilly has a good future as a comedian if he decides to retire.
Well,
he's good with the straight lines.
I think, frankly, any talk of O'Reilly retiring, I mean, he's talking about having to wear, you know, have bodyguards and bulletproof vests and things because these liberals are so dangerous and they're out to get him. And I think it's just because his ratings are tanking. You know, his Fox News ratings are actually doing pretty good, but his radio show is falling off the edge of the earth. And,
okay, well, thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks. Okay. I mean, that's my take on it. I mean, my general sense of it. Mike in Briar, Washington, on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey there, Tom. How's it going?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, Mike?
Oh, it's just I keep hearing something popping up on right-wing talk radio and all these right-wing ditto heads. They keep saying that just before the invasion, Saddam put all these nuclear weapons on the back of a truck and took it over the border to Iran and Syria. And unlike all these people, I've got a father-in-law who's a retired nuclear physicist, and he has some very choice words for people like this.
Yeah, it's just not possible, practical, certainly. And if we've got a satellite recon that can read a license plate from outer space, we certainly could have noticed them moving bombs.
Absolutely. Now, you know, can't talk about the chemical or the biological issue, but I suspect it's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
We were flying over that country constantly looking for targets. And if you can't see a convoy of trucks leaving the country carrying machinery on the back, what are we doing there?
Oh, I know. We're being fed some real lines here, Mike. Just some extraordinary lines that, I hope people start waking up from. One of the ones that I think is most extraordinary is that Osama bin Laden is still alive and a threat to us. I'm sure I have it here. The one of the newspapers in the Middle East ran an obituary for Osama bin Laden some years ago. And I thought I had it right here. Apparently I don't. I'll have to track it down and get it to you during the next segment. But they said he died at Tora Bora. And we haven't heard from him since. You know, there was one videotape. It was undated. Nobody really knew. And I'm telling you, I think that he's dead. I think he's been dead for a long time. And I think that Bush wants to keep him, you know, alive. As long as Bush has got a boogeyman, then he can say, oh, it's that guy's fault. And he doesn't have to then deal with the realities of policy. But anyhow, that's just another one that I think that they're keeping alive. Marjorie in Sacramento, California, listening on 1240 Talk City. Hey, Marjorie, what's up?
Hi, how you doing today?
I'm well. What's up?
I just wanted to call. I knew you were talking about voter fraud and things like that, and I'm a California resident, as you know, and we've had special elections the last 4 years in a row, and we're getting ready to have another one, and it's got 4 to 5 props on it that attack the unions and attack health care and do pretty much what the right-wing, you know, fascists like to do.
Yeah, and they're advertising like crazy for it. They're gonna carpet bomb the state with these things.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you have to wonder what you're gonna do. This is the last election that they can have in California before they have to have a paper trail. And I'll find it very interesting with all of the unions being mobilized and all that. If you know,
I thought they got rid of Kevin Shelley that part of that was they were going to get rid of the whole idea of the paper trails in California. Did I miss something?
No, we passed the law. We voted on it. I believe it was in the last special election. You know that by 2006 we would have paper trails, and there was the law. I'm not sure if it's been thrown out. You might have fresher information than me. But
well, and that's the other thing is there's a paper trail, and then there's a paper trail too. You know, if you're given a receipt
exactly.
that says you voted a certain way, that doesn't mean anything. It's
still unauditable. Yeah, I get my cell phone from a Diebold machine, and it gives me an exact replica receipt of everything that happens with my cell phone. And I'm wondering why I can't get that with my votes.
Well, that's a very good question. We can't do that. Sorry. Thanks a lot, Marjorie, for raising the issue. Appreciated. Ryan in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ryan, what's up?
Morning, Tom. I'm a Teamster, and I cannot understand why the Democratic Party does absolutely everything it can to undercut the union movement. They want open borders policy, which has done more to destroy the unions than anything else in the world.
I don't think the Democratic Party is in favor of an open borders policy.
Oh,
Bill
yes,
Clinton
they are.
Was. You know, Bill Clinton was pushing for NAFTA and GATT, but this is part of some party platform. What is it? Educate me. Apparently I've missed something.
Well, we have Minutemen on our northern border in this state.
Right.
The the Democratic Party leader came out and called these men old codgers and racist.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Ryan, you're raising a large issue here, and we're out of time. And I want to talk about it. So we'll pick it up toward the end of the next hour. And you know, trust me, we'll get back to this, the whole issue of open borders and illegal immigration, because it is a good one, and it is an important one. And the Democratic Party, in my opinion, I agree with you, okay, in part. The Democratic Party has this just as wrong as the Republican Party does. And you know, Americans need to be standing up and saying, there is a solution. And I'll share that with you in the next hour. We've got a guest coming up at the top of the hour, but after that, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Hey.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Hey, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you for the third hour of our program. The radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. John Spencer is with us. John is the former mayor of Yonkers from New York from 1996 till 2004. Describes himself as a conservative Republican. You're running against Hillary Clinton?
Yes, sir, I am, Tom.
Is there a Republican primary in which you're going to face some opposition, or is this a done deal? You're going to be the guy against her on the ticket?
No, it's not a done deal. The New York State Republican Party seems to have lost its way over the last 10 years. They've turned into a little satellite liberal Republican Party, so they're promoting another candidate. But in New York State, we have a conservative party, and I seek to secure that line because I'm a conservative Republican. And then I would primary the way it's going. The GOP's person who is a liberal, and I will put my Republican conservative record out there to the voters of New York State and have a primary. But I'll be on a conservative line either way. But I plan on also winning the Republican primary and then go against the real big liberal, Hillary Clinton.
There you go. Okay, John Spencer, former mayor of Yonkers. Now, are you still there, John? I'm assuming you can hear me.
Hello.
Yeah, oh, John, I can hear you. not sure what happened. You still there? John Spencer?
I lost somebody.
Yeah. John, the Tax Reform Commission, I'm just going to go ahead with this for a bit and hope that you can hear me. Maybe you're on a cell phone. I don't know. The Tax Reform Commission, you say, is
Hello?
Making a critical mistake by recommending that mortgage interest deductions. John, I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to let our engineers in New York City here work this out, and hopefully they can figure out what's going on. Maybe they need to call you back on another line, and we'll go on with this. But, you know, I wanted to have a conversation with a guy who wants to run against Hillary Clinton. Yeah, I found it particularly interesting that let's just try this one more time here.
Hello.
Hey, John, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Are you on a cell phone?
Yes, I am. I apologize, Tom.
Okay. Yeah,
It has worked, though, with a lot of other radio stations, so we should be all right.
Yeah, okay. Radio 101, always use a wired phone, but in any case. Okay. The President of the United States, a conservative Republican, George W. Bush, appointed a Blue Ribbon Commission to look into reforming the tax code of the United States, and one of the recommendations that they came back with was eliminating the deductibility of interest mortgage payments on homes over $300,000. You have a problem with that?
Yes, I do. I really do. I mean, I don't have a problem with President Bush and his desire to do some serious reform on our revenue streams, but you know, it's the panel's recommendation. But you know, That I don't agree with. That cuts down on investors. It cuts down on home sales. I think it's not the way to go.
And what isn't the current cap $500,000 right now?
I believe it is. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a $500,000. So you can deduct interest payments on up to a $500,000 mortgage. You know, $500,000 doesn't buy a whole lot of house in some parts of the United States.
No, and again, in this area, you know, that I represent, you know, Yonkers and seek to represent in New York State, would have a real, real negative impact on the market. And I think they won't be recommending that. I really don't.
Yeah,
it's not going to go anywhere.
I think it would be political suicide. And I just have to say, you know, as odd as it may sound to our listeners, I completely agree with you. I think that pulling the deductibility of mortgage interest deductions, I mean, this is the major savings instrument that most people in the American middle class have. And
right.
there already is a cap on it. Millionaires and billionaires, by and large, don't pay interest
right.
On their mortgages anyway. They don't have mortgages. They own
right.
their property outright. And
right.
so you know this. You know, so we're in agreement on this. You are saying, however, that you're supportive of George W. Bush's fiscal, economic, and tax policies. I'm just curious. How can you support increasing these massive tax increases, I mean, multi-trillion-dollar tax increases that George W. Bush has inflicted on the American people over the last 5 years?
You said tax increases?
That's right. That our children and grandchildren are going to have to pay. He's taken us from a $3 trillion debt to an $8 trillion debt. That has to be paid at some point. He hands a lot of that money to millionaires and billionaires and says, here, have some money. And he goes on TV and says it's a tax cut. But you and I both know, John, this is a tax increase.
No, I support the president on a tax cuts, and I support the effect of that has been a changing economy where the deficit is, in fact, shrinking, not growing. And I grant that. You know, I don't want to sound like a make an excuse politician, but we do have to deal with the reality of the economic impact, not only the human impact of September 11th, but it had an incredible economic impact on the United States.
No, it didn't, John. Come on, give me a break. This has got nothing to do with 9/11. This has got nothing to do with
9/11. You don't think 9/11 devastated New York? I'll tell you that financially.
Oh, sure, yeah, for 6 months. You know, for a year, for 2 years. But New York City is not the American economy.
What I'm saying, though, Tom, is that, I mean, just in general, I believe in tax cuts spur on investment, spur on the private side that creates jobs, and that cycle of the way it should be. Not in government spending. Granted, the administration does not have a good record on government spending. I mean, I'm disappointed in that. That the spending is...
John, just listen to this. You know, without... I mean, you tossed out a few things here that you know, we could jump up and down about, but let's just pick one. George W. Bush, in his first, you know, let's cut taxes and make jobs, said... first of all, you know, you say cutting taxes is going to increase jobs. It ain't ever happened. I mean, you know, find me one example of it ever happening in the United States. But here's George W. Bush saying that if we give wealthy people in the United States... $550,000, they will create one job, right? Here, I mean, that's his math. Here it is, right here.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Now, if you divide 1 million jobs into $550 billion, that's $550,000 per job he was proposing in what he called tax cuts, but really was tax deferrals. I mean, we're still going to have to pay the money. Somebody's going to have to pay those taxes for the money that he spent. And not only did it not create 1 million jobs, you know, we lost 2.5 million jobs.
Well, again,
what am I missing from this picture here, John?
And
why is it that anybody, I mean, what sane person would say, let's give somebody $550,000 and hope that they create a $30,000 a year job?
Well, I think you're circumventing the whole process by leaping to that, you know, from one end of the formula to the other. And again, I don't have facts and figures in front of me like you do right now. But again, just as a conservative Republican, I believe in the philosophy of cutting taxes and spurring on the private side to drive the engine of our social system, if you will. But
we're not cutting taxes. George Bush has never cut taxes. All he has done is postponed those taxes to the next generation. That's all he's ever done.
Well, we're playing with semantics here.
No, this is not semantics, John. This year, John, we are paying $160 billion in taxes. You and I, we're paying $160 billion in taxes on money that Ronald Reagan borrowed during his presidency to make it look like there were economic good times. Now, he called it a tax cut back then, but it wasn't, because you and I are paying the taxes right now. Bush is doing the same thing, only our children and grandchildren are going to pay the taxes. How can any ethical politician, and I'm assuming that you are one, John, how can any ethical politician call that a tax cut?
Well, because, well, then why are the Democrats attacking him and saying that roll back the tax cuts? What are they talking about when they say that?
They're saying if you're Mr. Bush and Republicans who control the House and the Senate and who originate the spending bills, if this is the government you want to have, then please pay for it. Don't ask our children.
Roll back the tax cuts. What are they talking about when they say that? What are they saying? What are they talking about when they say roll back tax cuts?
We would be glad to pay the taxes we paid under Bill Clinton in order to have the economy we had under Bill Clinton, in order to have a balanced budget. What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is that, the business world does change. It is a cyclical world we live in right now. The economy was coming back in the last 6 months of George Bush the first. I guess everyone forgets that, and all of a sudden Bill Clinton gets crazy.
That was right after he raised taxes, you'll recall.
For cyclical changes that happen in our society, it is like that graph going up and down and up and down. And all of a sudden, a guy gets in, was Bill Clinton in 1992, and all of a sudden, whatever year.
This is
SpencerForSenate.com.
SpencerForSenate.com. Thanks a lot for being with us. I appreciate it. Good talking to you. Good luck. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So a new man in the White House with a familiar name said he had some fresh ideas, but it's worse now since he came from Texas to Washington.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no! It's a corporation! It's not a person. Welcome back to the program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, actually what we'd settle for, a little democracy. All in favor of it, just a little democracy. So, thanks to John Spencer for coming on with us in the last segment. It is, I got to tell you, it is one hard job to get conservatives to come on this program. And I mentioned before the funeral of Osama bin Laden. This from the newspaper Al Wafad. And thanks to David, who sent this to me in an email, who tracked it down, and I went back and confirmed it. This from the newspaper Al Wafad, the Egyptian newspaper. Wednesday, December 26, 2001. December 26, 2001. Islamabad. A prominent official in the Afghan Taliban movement announced yesterday the death of Osama bin Laden, the chief of Al-Qaeda organization, stating that bin Laden suffered serious complications in the lungs and died a natural and quiet death. The official, who asked to remain anonymous, stated to the Observer of Pakistan, that's a newspaper there, that he had himself attended the funeral of bin Laden and saw his face prior to burial in Tora Bora 10 days ago. He mentioned that 30 of Al-Qaeda's fighters attended the burial, as well as members of his family and some friends from the Taliban. In the farewell ceremony to his final rest, guns were fired in the air. The official stated that it is difficult to pinpoint the burial location of bin Laden because, according to Wahhabi tradition, no mark is left by the grave. You'll recall the king of Saudi Arabia just recently died and is buried in an unmarked grave. He stressed that it is unlikely that the American forces will ever uncover any trace of bin Laden. 2001. Bin Laden's been dead for 4 years. I believe it. In fact, I'm convinced of it. You'll recall when the Ayatollah Khomeini, the Ayatollah, the Grand Ayatollah of Iran, was banished from Iran by Raza Pahlavi, if I'm pronouncing that right, the Shah of Iran, our guy, the guy that we put into power. And he went to France, the Ayatollah Khomeini. And he went to France and did an amazing thing, which I believe Osama bin Laden was trying to do when he was still alive. The Grand Ayatollah, the Ayatollah Khomeini, started recording audio tapes. Now, this was, you know, of course, in the 70s. I mean, the technology, video technology was a relatively new thing. Not everybody had video players. It was hard to transport them, all that kind of thing. And there weren't all the, you know, the simple standards that we have now. And there wasn't an internet out there. He recorded every week an audio tape. And they would smuggle a copy or copies of those audio tapes, those weekly audio tapes, out of France, where the Ayatollah was staying in exile, into Iran, where his followers would make thousands of copies of these audio tapes and distribute them. And all over Iran, for years, we're talking 3, 4, 5 years, every Friday for Friday prayers in the mosques that were aligned with the Ayatollah, and in private rooms, private homes, people would sit and they would listen to that weekly tape from the Ayatollah Khomeini. So that when the Shah fell, when the Shah got cancer and he could no longer hold power, and, you know, he came over to the United States here, Jimmy Carter tried to, you know, get him some therapy and all that. When the Shah fell, the Ayatollah was ready to step into that vacuum because he had created a power base by sending out those weekly audio tapes. And I guarantee you, if Osama bin Laden was alive today, he would be doing the same thing. And he's not. Because he viewed himself as a latter-day Saladin, as the new leader of the Muslim, or of the Arab world, well, of the Muslim world, beyond just the Arab world. He viewed himself as the guy who was going to unite the Islamic world against the Western world and return it back to, in his mind, it's medieval glory. And I'm just telling you, if Osama bin Laden was alive today, he'd be making tapes every week. He'd be sending them out just like the Ayatollah did. This is what Sistani did. Ayatollah Sistani, when he was in exile from Iraq in Iran, he was making tapes and sending them into Iraq. It's not like, you know, when we went in and we blew Saddam Hussein out of the water and, you know, took over the country. It was like all of a sudden Ayatollah Sistani shows up in Iraq. The guy's an Iranian. It's not like all of a sudden he shows up and says, hey, here I am. And the people go, oh, nice. No, he had millions of followers. How did he get millions of followers? Every few, I don't know what the frequency was with Sistani, but presumably at least once a month, probably every week for Friday prayers, he was sending tapes into Iraq. It was contraband, it was underground, it was, you know, but it was there. I'm telling you, Osama would be doing it. He died in December of 2001. 27 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Yay.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Don't worry about a thing. Every little bit gonna be all right.
Yeah, we're going to work it out, my friends. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 and a half minutes past the hour. I was having this conversation with Paul Loeb yesterday after we got off the air. Paul and I went out to lunch at a nearby Ethiopian restaurant, my favorite food, Dalos restaurant here in Portland, Oregon. It's amazing. Three of us, Paul, Louise, and I, all three of us had lunch. All we could eat, it was $10. And it's just wonderful. In any case, we're sitting around having lunch, and the issue of what's the future going to bring? You know, what's going to come? Is it possible? Are we going to melt down? Is the political disaster that bad? How's it? Procter & Gamble, for example, the world's biggest packaged goods marketer, are they breaking the law by enlisting teens to coax friends to try teen-tailored products, asks Bruce Horowitz in USA Today today, for example. I mean, you know, just corporations run amok. What are we going to do about, Paul was talking about this book, The Long Emergency, what are we going to do about peak oil? You know, the end of the era of oil. And what kind of crisis, and I pointed out, it's already here. And there are many countries around the world that are already experiencing terrible, terrible turmoil as the result of peak oil. But there is, you know, there is one place where I depart from the doomsayers. And it's why I wrote the book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which is actually about peak oil. Ancient sunlight is oil, right? Oil is, you know, plants caught sunlight 400 million years ago. It got, and it's now oil and coal as well and natural gas. So anyhow, we're in the time of peak oil, Hubbert peak. And I remember years ago when Julian Simon was still alive. He was the left, as it were, loved to make Julian Simon this big bugaboo. He was a professor at Columbia University. He died a couple of years ago. And in fact, on Dan Quinn's, Daniel Quinn, the author of Ishmael, which is a book that if you haven't read, you must read. But I digress. Daniel Quinn on his website, which I believe is Ishmael.com, his opening page was, it said, do you want to save the world? Yes or no? And if you clicked yes, you went into Dan Quinn's website. If you clicked no, you went to Julian Simon's website. So it was like, Julian Simon was this guy who, you know, he was widely viewed as kind of one of the theoreticians of the conservatives. And he had this bet with Paul Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb back in the 1970s. Paul Ehrlich was saying, you know, within 30 years, the price of copper is going to be going through the roof. Nickel is going to go through the roof. Aluminum, because these are things that, you know, they're going to get more and more rare as population goes up and consumption goes up. Makes sense. And Julian Simon said, no, the price is actually going to go down on those things. And so they had a bet. You know, it was like a 10-year bet. And Julian Simon won the bet. And the basis of his thinking, and again, there's, you know, probably 80, 90% of what Julian Simon says I disagree with. But I think he's right on this one thing. And I think it's something that those of us who are concerned about the future of the United States and of the world really need to be remembering. Julian Simon made the point that of all the kinds of wealth that we have as humans, and you look back over, you know, 160-some-odd thousand years of human history, I think the oldest known fossils that have been reliably dated are around 160,000 years of fully modern human beings. Throughout that entire history of humanity, our greatest wealth hasn't been in our fuel supply. It hasn't been in our food supply. It hasn't been in how much gold we have. It's been in our minds. Our greatest wealth is our ability to adapt to any environment, to adapt to any circumstances, to figure out a way through things, to figure out a way around things, to figure out how to do things better. Very often we screw it up. Very often we screw it up. And again, one of our greatest wealths is that we can figure out, hey, we screwed it up. What was this slavery thing we had? What was this women can't vote thing we had? You know, we screwed up a lot of things. And then we said, hey, wait a minute, the old forehead slap. We screwed it up. Let's fix it. So, I am very concerned about the end of the age of oil. I mean, as I said, I wrote a book about it. A best-selling book that's available in 15, I think, languages around the world and published by Random House. I mean, it's out there. It's a real book, real publisher and all that. And in that book and in my speaking in general, I don't worry, be happy, but we will figure out a way through this. And frankly, I think it could be a wonderful transition if we do it right. Look at what they're doing in Germany now. I was talking to a friend of mine just the other day who lives in Steinach, the city where I used to live in Germany back in the mid-80s when my family and I lived in Germany. And this little business that they run, it's actually a nonprofit, it's a charity, Kinder and Jugendhilfswerk Salem, that I've worked for as a volunteer for 28 years now, doing international relief projects. They just got a huge grant from the German government to put solar collectors on their roof to collect electricity. Now, this is in a part of Germany where it's generally pretty rainy, pretty drizzly, but still, there's sunlight getting through. And they put these solar collectors on, and everybody's putting these things on because the government just created this huge program to put solar collectors on people's houses all over the place. And he was telling me about it. You know, it's, their meter runs backwards sometimes. And I was talking with John, I'm forgetting his last name, the guy who's the president of Real Goods, realgoods.com, at the Bioneers Conference over the weekend. And John was saying, you know, one of the problems right now in the solar power business, which is booming, is that Germany is like soaking up 80% of the world's production. Because they've decided as a country that they're going solar. And they're doing it. Well, it's just a matter of time before it happens here. You have 30 million homes in China right now that are heated with solar power. 30 million. You don't hear much about it in the American press, where you got big, you know, press corporations that have interlocking boards of directors with big oil companies, but it's there. So, and I just, you know, I think that, you know, time and common sense, enough of us wake up. I actually see a good day coming. Yeah, we're going to have some challenges. We have a lot of challenges right now. We've got a terrible problem with poverty in the United States, the working poor, the conservatives trying to destroy the middle class, trying to create a ruling elite of inherited wealth and corporate power. Yes, and it's not the first time it's happened in the United States. We went through this in the 30 years before the Great Depression. It was called the robber baron era. We went through this in the 20 or so years before the Civil War. There was, you know, the Great Depression of the 1840s and the 1850s. There were several of them, actually. The Great Panic of 1856. We went through this in the 1850s, in the 1750s. It was one of the things that led to the American Revolution, actually. All the way up right through the 1770s. I mean, one of the reasons that the British East India Company in 1773 asked for a tax break, which the Tax Act of 1773 that led to the Boston Tea Party, because it was a corporate tax break, and the colonists said, hey, don't be giving corporate tax breaks to East India Company. The reason they asked for it was because of the economic conditions. So, you know, people respond. We figure things out. We fix things. We've been through a number of energy sources. We had, you know, whale oil was getting in short supply at one point in this country, and we made a transition. So there is so much solar power. There's so much wind power. There's so much geothermal power. You just, you know, put a bunch of barges out in the ocean, attach a lever to them, and connect them to generators and just take the tides, I mean, are incredible. There is, you know, I'm an optimist. What can I say? So I don't know why I got off on that. I guess it was that bumper music. Grant in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Grant, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
I can.
Yes. First, a suggestion that some webmaster out there create a website for all the Gold Star families to enter the name of someone they've lost so we can get an accurate assessment of how many people have really died over there.
You know, there are a couple of different groups that have tried doing that, Grant, and the problem has been, as far as I can tell, that no one large group, you know, one umbrella group that has the kind of national gravitas to pull it off has done it. It would be a great thing for example, MoveOn.org to do, or the Democratic Party, for that matter. And so, you know, I encourage you to keep suggesting that.
May I make my point?
Sure.
I was drafted in 69 into the Army anyway. During our rifle training, we were instructed, the lieutenants would say, what are we? And we would yell back, killers. And they would say, and who do we kill? And we would have to say, the sick, the lame, and the lazy. My niece, 20 years later, Marine Corps, was taught the same thing. And when I thought, watching the New Orleans thing, in New Orleans, I thought, what was left behind but sick people, lame people, and for all the racist, lazy people?
Wait a minute. This is you were in the Marine Corps?
In the Army.
In the Army.
But my niece is in the Marines, and I talked to
the
Marines.
The sick, the lame, and the lazy? I mean,
my niece, 20 years later, Marine Corps, was taught the same thing. And when I thought, watching the New Orleans thing, in New Orleans, I thought, what was left behind but sick people, lame people, and for all the racist, lazy people?
Wait a minute. This is you were in the Marine Corps?
In the Army.
In the Army.
But my niece is in the Marines, and I talked to
the
Marines.
The sick, the lame, and the lazy? I mean,
that's who was instructed that we were killed. The point I'm making is
I'm having a hard time believing that, Grant.
Well, it's the God's truth. You know. May my children go to hell if I'm lying, okay?
No, okay.
All right? And now the point I'm making is that when I watched after Katrina, how many sick people, and what I thought when I heard this in the Army, because I didn't attend the first 3 days of rifle training because I was in the hospital, I thought, who are the sick, lame, and lazy really threatened? Well, they threaten the exploiters.
Grim stuff. I mean, I went through basic training in the Air Force, and I never encountered
anything
like that.
Well, you're in the Air Force. This is the Army, and I want to become a medic. But the point I'm making is this is in 1969, and 20 years later, the Marine Corps. My niece tells me this, that I asked her. I didn't suggest...
fall. Anyway, welcome back. 1-866-440-8466. 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M, the telephone number. Scott, listening on AM 1090, Progressive Talk Radio in Seattle, KTPK, or KPTK. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to say that I think that it would be a far more grand thing for the United States through diplomacy to convince the new Iraqi government not to execute Saddam Hussein. That Saddam Hussein, of course, has already lost two sons. I think that executing Saddam Hussein would be treating the situation exactly the same way that Saddam Hussein would treat the situation.
Well, that's the argument against capital punishment. And, I broadly speaking, I have to say, Scott, I don't disagree with you at all. The problem is that Iraq executed a half a dozen criminals last week. I mean, they have capital punishment there. It's L. Paul Bremer, as part of the neocon, rewrite of their laws or writing of their laws. They had capital punishment, of course, before. And if you're going to apply capital punishment to people who commit murder, then that's what you do.
Well, I just wanted to air this notion. I hadn't heard anyone else air the notion, and I think that it's worthwhile considering.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. I agree with you in the context of I think that capital punishment, the reason why I am an opponent to capital punishment is twofold. Number one, it's never been shown to actually have any effect. Now, people say, well, what about those people who didn't get killed by the guy who got out? Well, yeah. If you let people out, then you could say capital punishment has an effect. But assuming that you have a functioning criminal justice system, capital punishment doesn't deter crime. People say, well, the criminal justice system doesn't always function perfectly. Some of those killers are going to get out. Well, if that's the case, it doesn't always function perfectly, and some of the killers get out, then it's also the case that some people are going to get killed who are not killers. And so it's just, it's a risk that I don't think is a healthy one for society, number one. But the main reason I'm opposed to capital punishment is because I think it brutalizes society. I think as we kill, we teach killing. And that's not the lesson that we want. I think that's one of the big transformations, frankly, from the Old Testament to the New Testament. If you want to get religious about it, probably shouldn't. Doug in Sacramento, California, listening on Talk 1240, Talk City, Sacramento. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Well, I was hearkening back to your discussion about Bush and Condi, et cetera.
Yeah.
I would like folks to think about the situation with Nixon and Ford.
You know, I was going to mention that. Spiro Agnew was going to be convicted of fraud in New Jersey, was it?
Yes, something like that.
Yeah.
And then he appointed Ford as vice president and then resigned, and then Ford pardoned him for his involvement in the Watergate thing.
Right.
I looked at the possibility of that happening here. If he makes Condi vice president, then he resigns and she steps up. She becomes the first female black president. Takes away Hillary's credit.
Yeah, and she would be very hard to beat in 2008. And you can bet that there's a whole lot of Republicans doing the calculus on that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Back to another issue you had earlier.
Sure.
About bin Laden being dead. There's also press out there that says Zarqawi's dead.
Yeah, or that Zarqawi never really existed.
That too,
he was,
yeah.
The main consensus, I think, among intelligence professionals, Doug, is that, Zarqawi is, to a large extent, an invention of the American military because, he's here, he's there, he's over there, he's in 15 cities at once. He's, he appears, he disappears. He's, yeah, right. We got to have a bugaboo. That's the bottom line. Mark in Seattle. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Great. What's up?
Well, I'm a reporter up here and also on the board of directors for a media literacy group, and I originally had called to talk about the Minutemen up here at the U.S.-Canadian border.
Yes, I promised to get back to the topic, and I failed to. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I sent you an email on that, and you said you were going to forward that to your producers. But I'll tell you, as I was listening and you brought up the story about bin Laden, now I'm really intrigued, and I'm really interested in following up on this story. And I was wondering if, do you have any of that information on the website, or can you give me the original reference for that so we could try to track that down and maybe get a response from the White House?
Yeah, where did it go? I don't have it in here. I think David has it. Wait a minute. Maybe this is it. Nope. David, do you have that in there? Oh, that's right. I put it in the stack there. Never forget it. Grab it and bring it in here, and I'll share it with you right now here, Mark.
I have another question for you, sure. too, actually. We wanted to send you a DVD of from our media literacy program. It's called Weapons of Mass Distraction, and it's sort of looking into the corporate media and
yeah.
trying
My
to...
My address is on our website, Mark. And I actually get mail there. So here's
the website?
Yeah, it's on the website.
Great.
The article came out of the Egyptian newspaper Al-Wafd, W-A-F-D, and it was published December 26, 2001, volume 15, number 4633. Headline, News of Bin Laden's Death and Funeral 10 Days Ago. Dateline Islamabad. You ought to be able to easily Google it with that.
Wow. Thank you so much. Have you heard of any response from the Pentagon or the White House on this issue?
No, I mean, this has been raised a whole bunch of times. And back, you know, there was a lot of speculation after the bombing at Tora Bora that that's when and where he died. And we pretty much haven't heard from him since then. And I think that that's what happened. I think the guy's gone. You know, he's gone. Because, as I said, if he were around, he would be around. We'll talk about illegal immigration soon, I promise you. We will get back to that topic. David is busy at work tracking that. What I really like to do is get somebody on, you know, one of these folks, like one of these Minutemen folks. We'll get one of these guys on the program and talk to them. Thank you so much for being with us today. Much appreciated. We'll see you again tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.